Well, we're nearly there, guys. We are on the homeward stretch to the end of the year, which is pretty awesome, and that many of you will get time off, which is really good. For me, I'm not quite sure where my time off sort of starts and begins on a day-by-day basis, let alone on any holidays. But that's cool because I guess I get a few less emails and phone calls and things like that, so I get a bit more stuff done. But, you know, look, life will go on. We tend to see a bunch of really interesting InfoSec things happen over Christmas. I don't know what it is. Sometimes I think hackers just like screwing with kids. Incidentally, on that, now that I think of it, we have seen multiple incidents over Christmas where we've seen the likes of Steam, we saw Xbox Live, saw PSN, all DDoSed over Christmas periods in years gone by. And I get this sort of picture in my mind that someone is just basically playing like the Grinch with kids. You know, like you've got your new games console, let us screw that up for you. So maybe we'll see that over Christmas. I don't know. Anyway, as of today, I am obviously home, which is good. Since last week, I've been in Melbourne for a couple of days. I was there Monday and Tuesday. No, actually, other way around. I'm losing track now. I was in Sydney, Melbourne and Tuesday. And then I was in Melbourne yesterday, and then I flew back home to the Gold Coast this morning. And I was doing some talks there for CFC Underwriting, who do cyber insurance. And it was a combination of them and then a company called Aon that actually sells the insurance here in Australia. And I learned something interesting out of this I thought I'd share, because you might have just heard like cyber and insurance together and gone, oh God. And in all honesty, like, this has often been my perception, and that I'm sort of going, maybe like less cyber and insurance and stuff and more fixing all your broken shit would be a good way to go about things. But I actually learned a few interesting things. There were a bunch of very nice people, and we had some good chats, both as part of their presentation. So I did a presentation, and there were other cyber insurance presentations. And also over beers, where many, many good chats and many good things are often learned. And one of the things I learned, which is quite interesting, is that obviously what happens with cyber insurance is organizations have risk assessments that are done on them in terms of, yeah, effectively ultimately calculating premiums. It's a little bit like if you're a 20-year-old male with a high-performance car, you're going to have a high premium because there's a pretty good chance you're going to crash. If you are a 50-year-old woman with a small-capacity car, and I hope I haven't just done the man-woman thing here, but I think you know what I'm trying to get at. If you're in a much lower risk category, and incidentally, insurance does well and truly see gender. Ask me how I know. Car insurance. So the point is that there are different levels of risk, and if you were to do things to reduce your risk, so for example, get older when it comes to cars, then premiums come down. Now, with the cyber insurance thing, one of the interesting things that happens here is that as you reduce your risk as an organization, you spend less money on insurance, and you still get the same cover. So you can actually, and I really hate to think that I'm suddenly starting to sound like a cyber insurance salesman, but you can see how that would actually incentivize organizations to do better. And that's the bit that I'm actually kind of happy about. I like the idea of saying, hey, company A, B, if you train more people, if you have more penetration tests done, if you have other appliances that might help you do your security better, we're going to financially incentivize you. So I had a little bit of a change of mindset, if I'm honest, when I went to that event. I'm not sure that I'm entirely convinced that it's always a good thing to do, and I think there are other bigger issues at stake here, but that bit I thought was interesting. Now, this week, despite all the travel, I wrote three pieces, and some of it actually had quite a bit of stuff go into it, and some of it has actually gotten quite a bit of airtime, which has been interesting. So the first thing on Monday is I wrote about a new Pluralsight course. Now, this is a new course, but it's one that I recorded back in August with Lars Klint. And this is another one of these play-by-plays where you have two people and they're sitting there, they're both facing you like this, and we do screencasts, we do audio, we do video, and we talk about topics which then become sort of a conversation between two people, so a little less formal than a normal Pluralsight course, a little more consumable by the masses. And we did one called What You Need to Know About HTTPS Today. Now, you may be thinking, you've written a lot of stuff about HTTPS lately. Do you really need to create more HTTPS content? The third thing I'm going to talk about today, that was the first thing. Forget about the cyber insurance stuff. That was just casual banter. The third thing I'm going to talk about today shows exactly why we still have fundamental misunderstandings with HTTPS and why it is still a topic that needs to be discussed. But this one, at the time, I wanted to talk about things like obviously the rapid growth in or adoption of an HTTPS. So I checked the figures again yesterday. We're at almost 70% of traffic sent over the web. So HTTP-based traffic is sent over HTTPS. It's gotten very, very big. We're seeing lots of other things happen with HTTPS. You guys have heard me talk about the fact that Chrome now, since I think Chrome 63 in October, will show warnings if you type anything into a box that served over HTTP and not HTTPS. Obviously, in January, we got Firefox and Chrome showing warnings for insecure password pages or credit card pages as well, which is very, very good. A bunch of other stuff happening as well. We've had things like Start SSL has just finally effectively died. They've shut up shop because they were doing dodgy things in conjunction with WoSign. And I kind of rattle off a whole bunch of things. I'm going to look at what I rattled off now. Rattled off a whole bunch of things related to how quickly HTTPS is changing. Another one here, we had Chrome earlier this year removing support for SHA-1 certificates, which was good. What else we had? Oh, we had that really awesome one, which I've spoken about before, where there was a website that tried to suppress warnings on password pages served insecurely by changing the password field to a text field and then using a font that made all your characters look like stars on the text field. I know, it's insane. Believe me or not, it happened. I've linked to it in the blog post about that Pluralsight play-by-play. Now, that course is only about an hour. It's the sort of thing that is either good for you to watch on the train on your way to work or to give your less technical manager or significant other at home if you want to get them interested in this stuff. Give them that content because that is very easily consumable by everyone by design. And then if you want to go deep, there's that course I did earlier this year about what every developer needs to know about HTTPS. So anyway, I'm really happy. Those courses are rating really well because people are starting to pay a lot of attention to HTTPS, which is good news. Now, something that is less good news, and that's Face ID. Now, look, I did a video on this. You know, it's like a half hour video, I think, in total, because I wanted to show different circumstances of using Face ID. And effectively, it stinks. And I'll just let that sink in for a moment. It's been a long day. I'm sipping coffee for those of you listening to the podcast. Now, stinks is kind of a strong term, and I changed that term because Phil Schiller came out only last week and said, look, all the Apple competitors to Face ID, the other sort of facial biometrics, stink. And when I saw that, I went, Phil, mate, it's hard to tell you, hard to express just how frequently this stinks for me. Now, this is one of the takeaways from the post. And one of the reasons why I like doing the weekly updates and I talk about the videos and things is because I then get to talk about feedback that people gave me. And a lot of people actually had feedback where they said, look, Face ID doesn't stink so much for me. It's good. Some people said it's better than Touch ID. And that's great. Awesome. One of the things about it is it's very environmentally dependent. So when I did the video earlier this week, I wanted to sort of show how for me, in the circumstances in which I use it, and some of them will be common with the circumstances anyone uses it, but for me, it sucks, stinks, is what Phil said, stinks. It stinks because of several reasons. Now, one of them is because this is a sunny environment. So the place I live, literally, legally, for want of a better term, by the weather forecasters, has 300 days of sunshine a year. So it is constantly sunny. You can see the sun actually starting to creep in just here because I'm doing this a bit late in the day. Constantly very sunny, constantly wearing sunglasses. Actually, one of the things I learned from that article is people didn't realize Australians call sunglasses sunnies. They also think we mean something totally different when we say thongs as well, but I won't delve into that just here. Anywho, so one of the big problems is it really struggles with sunglasses. So I have two different pairs of sunglasses I wear a lot. Some I wear when I'm playing tennis and I'm doing sort of active things. Others are more sort of, you know, classy kind of sunglasses for when you're being a bit more presentable. Both polarized, both have a heap of trouble. And it's just constant. Even since I wrote that post and did the video, I've been more conscious of it. And it's just, it is a constant frustration. I also made the point that when you, it's just little things, like if you have your phone flat on a desk and you want to unlock it, you have to kind of go, oh, you know, look, there's my phone down there. Like, you've got to rearrange yourself to fit around Face ID. And that there are some sort of behavioral changes I'm okay with, but some of this is pretty fundamental too. And frankly, there are just a lot of occasions where it is flaky. Literally, and I'm not making this up, at lunch today, Kylie and I went and had lunch at a sushi restaurant, and she's, no sunglasses indoors, she's unlocking this. I can't say the word that she told me where, as she was trying to explain how she felt about Face ID, but you probably have heard it before, and it wasn't unlocking and she wasn't very happy. Indoors, normal circumstance. This is one of the points I made in the video. This is not just a me thing. So she struggles with it. My sister-in-law, who also lives here and has an iPhone 10, also struggles with it. It's just, it's a shame because I wanted it to be better than it is. Now, a lot of people said in the comments, some people, and I forget which are comments and which are responses on Twitter, said things like, you know, look, well, are you going to get rid of it now? I'm not going to get rid of the phone because the phone is freaking awesome in every way except for Touch ID. I love that big screen. The camera rocks. I'm very comfortable not having a home button, swiping and doing all the magic gesture tricks. All of that's awesome. So I'm not going to get rid of the phone because it would also mean selling what is an expensive phone and then going and getting something which in some ways would feel like a retrograde because you'd be back to an 8 probably plus in this case. I think for the most part, people gave me really good feedback. sometimes I wish I didn't read the comments. There's one guy, I assume guy, who made a comment about it doesn't work for me because of a privileged lifestyle. And I'm not sure if he meant because I have sunshine. Maybe he was English and he felt that sunshine was a privilege. Sorry, guys, you know that we all have fun with this. Maybe he didn't like the fact that I had a pool. Maybe he didn't like the fact that I had a car. And part of the problem was when it's in the car, it's not facing you. But, you know, as I said to him, look, if all you have is a rock or ground and you sit the phone flat on your rock or ground, you will have the same problem. But frankly, anyone who's able to go and buy an iPhone 10, and the things are selling like hotcakes, but they are in a pretty good position because, look, they're not cheap gear, right? But I think that's also why I expected more of it. Anyway, let's move on past that. I'm going to keep persevering with the phone because I don't have a choice, but I will be thinking more seriously about it when the next edition comes out, and I'm going to hope they get this a lot better. Now, the next thing, and this brings us back to HTTPS, and look, I haven't done a good company smackdown for a while, you know? And I understand that this can be a bit polarizing. And in fact, maybe this is one of the things we'll talk about today. I have been known over the years to be very direct with my views of how I feel some companies are handling their security. And many of you may remember incidents like Tesco many years ago. And look, arguably, these things have gotten a lot of press and have sort of helped me build awareness of what it is that I do. And part of it is tearing strips off these companies. And I want to set a bit of context here because I don't want people to feel like this is just me being a dick, because that's not the intention at all. Many times when I've written about organizations with poor security behavior, it's not due to one thing or one mistake by one person. It's usually a series of events, or it's a series of egregious problems, or it's a bad way in which the organization has handled it. And there's a bit of me that goes, there is a point that you get to where it's like, okay, now it's fair game. And I want to give you an example, because the thing I wrote about only Wednesday was about NatWest, which is a UK bank. Now, let's do this in chronological order. Someone brought to my attention on December 13, which actually would have been Wednesday. I had plans Wednesday, and then this happened. Brought this to my attention where NatWest, the bank, is serving their landing page over HTTP. So this brings us back to HTTPS again. So they're not HTTPS, HTTP. And you then go to the top right-hand corner of the page and you click the login link. And there's a padlock next to the login link. It's a bitmap, guys. It doesn't mean anything. And you click that and then you go to another domain which is served over HTTPS. And someone sort of said, you know, hey, NatWest, like, really, your landing page should be over HTTPS. Yes, your login page is HTTPS, that's good. But if I was to type in natwest.com, and you would think as a NatWest customer, that's probably where you're going to start, like the name of the company.com. And I was to go to your login page, or rather go to your landing page, that landing page is insecure. Someone could manipulate that traffic, do things, and I may not actually end up on the secure page. Now, one of the things I find quite interesting here when we talk about the rate of change with HTTPS is that probably only a year ago, this really wouldn't have warranted much community outrage. You know, like our expectations about how people implement security, how companies implement security, is changing rapidly to the point where not so long ago, this really wouldn't have been an issue. I mean, not so long ago, we were having the arguments the whole time about your login page isn't served over HTTPS. That's rare to have that argument now because of the things that Chrome and Firefox did back in Gen. So anyway, we've moved the bar. And now the bar is that there is an expectation that particularly something like a financial institution serves their homepage, landing page, over HTTPS. Now, we then began a series of to and fro. And when I say we, the Twitter community and NatWest began a series of to and fro, which has played out many times before, where the community says, you're doing something shit. The organization says, no, we're not because reasons. The community says, well, actually, and then it goes from there. So the way this one played out is NatWest said, look, everything is cool when you enter your credentials. It's secure. Community, and there are a couple of different guys that raised this, said, well, actually, the problem is that you can't trust the site that your customers are initially going to, therefore you're going to have problems. Now, at one point, because I kept getting CC'd in this, at one point I chimed in and I said, this is really not such a good thing. And there's a point here where they say, so this is their justification. Hi there, Troy. The website contains general information. Rest assured when you are logging in that the website is secure. Please feel free to DM me if you have any more, and they said any more in one word, which I think is a bit weird, any more queries around this. So this is their justification, right? It's like your data are secure before you actually log in. The public site is just generic stuff. Don't worry about it. And there'd already been a bit of to and fro by this point. So I said to them, you're missing the point. When people want to log on, they go to your homepage. The homepage is insecure, so you can't trust anything on it. The link on the login page is on it. You can't trust the link on the login page. Makes sense. Now, to me, that was like about as clear and simple as you could make it. Very direct, very to the point. I don't think anyone would argue that it was condescending or anything like that. And then they replied, and this is one of these classic things where I'm sure people at NatWest were beating their heads against the wall after they saw this. NatWest says, I'm sorry you feel this way. I can certainly pass on your concerns and feed this back to the tech team for you, Troy. And I had to read it multiple times just to be sure that this was actually right. You know, like basically they said, I'm sorry, Troy, that you feel that this is the way the technology works. No, this is not me feeling it. It's like, this is the way it works. This is not an emotional reaction or a personal determination by myself. This is how the thing works. This is what the problem is. You know, like at least acknowledge it. Now, that was the point to my earlier initiation of this discussion here. That was the point where it got to, okay, now it's fair game to try and make a rather poignant issue out of this. So I wrote a blog post and I explained the whole thing. And look, for those of you listening to this, like you understand what this is almost certainly, you know, like you could change the login link to anything else because you can't trust the traffic in the middle. My good friend Scott Helm did a video of SSL strip. An SSL strip, if you've not seen it before, allows a man in the middle to sit there, get requests coming from the client, proxy them onto the server, get any sort of 301 redirects or anything that come back and talk to the server with HTTPS and then just talk to the server with client. Talk to the client with clear text. So it effectively allows the client to have the full website experience, but all the HTTPS is only done between the man in the middle and the server. And it's only possible if a man in the middle can intercept an insecure request and then start relaying things backwards and forwards between the two parties. So we had lots of stuff up there, lots of sort of examples of, look, here's where it all goes wrong. I referred to Comcast as well. In case you haven't seen it, Comcast has been in the news because Comcast, the US ISP, has a penchant for injecting many hundreds of lines of JavaScript into insecure responses when they want to send messages to customers. And that sounds as shit as it is. Read the post and you can actually see the script that's in there. I've embedded someone's tweet. And I kind of made the point that, you know, look, traffic gets man in the middle all the time. Now, it's not always necessarily with malicious intent. I don't think Comcast is malicious intent, but there are still other parties in there reading, manipulating, and possibly redirecting your traffic. You know, try going to a hotel and opening a browser full of tabs when you first log on, and you'll get captive portal redirected on every single one of them. That is not secure. And again, that's the key point there. So it happens all the time. Now, I pushed this out on Wednesday my time. Would have been Wednesday evening my time. And a lot of people found it very interesting. I think I had 60,000 views of that post on Wednesday. So it got a lot of traction. And then I got up this morning my time, and it's on the front page of the BBC's tech section. So they got themselves some good coverage. And I don't know if they're still sorry I feel this way, or if they're sorry they're on the front page of the BBC. But that got picked up, got a lot of traction. They've fixed it already. So yeah, here's the bit where I want to go, okay, look, let's actually acknowledge good work as well, because they have fixed this. I understand at the end of the day, despite all the comments which seem to imply I didn't understand, that there is a social media minion controlling the social media. And things like "I'm sorry you feel that way" are like social media point 15B. We will use this when things get escalated to a point, and this is the standard response. I get all that. But regardless of outsourcing the social media account or offshoring or whatever they do, the organization is still responsible for what it says. This is how it works. The buck stops with them. So the point is that they did actually pick up on this and they did fix it. And that's good news. Now, they actually have a little mixed content problem there. So they probably should have read that six-step happy path to HTTPS post that I linked to in there, which talked about upgrading secure requests, which would have fixed that for them. But kudos to them for actually trying to do the right thing and move that discussion forward and actually fix the thing. One last thing on this. Again, one thing I'm really conscious of, and I think people who read my content sometimes miss this, is that whilst we have social media minions out there being the public face of the company, and even whilst we have many spokespeople for the company, even C-suite execs who stand up there and say certain things, behind that, there is inevitably a team of people, probably just like you and I, trying to do their job, trying to build these systems. And a lot of them know that stuff like this is a terrible practice. They know this. They're smart people. And they're stuck in this situation where they're having to work with these constraints because the marketing manager just hasn't prioritized that thing that they'd really like to do. So I get that. And I know that there are people out there doing good work that are very frustrated by that. So if you're one of these people and you just see me sort of hammering away at NatWest as it may be, trust me, I feel your pain, and believe me, I have been in your shoes so many times in the past as well. The memories are still very raw. So that was those guys. So last thing this week, my sponsor is Matchlight by Terbium Labs. So Terbium Labs is another long-time sponsor, so I'm very, very glad that those guys have been around for quite some time. They picked a great week to be up there as well, because that NatWest stuff did get a lot of traction. So yeah, I hope for these sponsors that they do get a little bit more awareness of their brand, and people do click on the links and have a look at what they do, because they're interested enough in me. And they just, incidentally, this is not like some random sign-ups and then you get a sponsorship slot on Troy's blog. Like, we always have discussions. I say no to a bunch of people who ask because their message just is simply not one I feel having comfortable or feel comfortable having on my site. So for folks like Matchlight from Terbium, I'm definitely comfortable with them. I know who these guys are. So do check them out, because they do help me do what I do. On that as well, I think I mentioned last week I was looking for sponsors for 2018. I've now sold, I think, about 80% of my 2018 sponsorship. And it's spread out all over the year as well. So I still got gaps all through the year too that I can fill stuff in on. But I'm just really happy that this thing is working so well. So last thing, I was just before I did this, I was looking at my travel stats, because I have gotten off my last aeroplane for 2017 today. And believe me, that makes me very, very happy. Got off my last aeroplane. Apparently, compared, I'm doing this a bit late today. I got up really early, had an interstate flight. I'm surviving on coffee before it's beer o'clock, and I'm struggling a little bit. So I'll try it again. Looking at my travel stats for the year, apparently I've had 53 flights this year, which is a new record. 181,000 kilometers, 245 hours in the air, which is, well, man, that's more than 10 days sitting in the air. And unfortunately, this does not track how much time I spend sitting in airports or transiting places, but it would probably be at least another 50% of that too. TripIt tells me 134 days away, which I worked out is about 37% of the year as well. My goal, if I'm honest, is to make those stats less impressive next year. So I mentioned a while ago, I'm starting to do workshops remotely as one part of trying to stay home more. But I have just turned that corner of, you know, the travel is really cool, let's go and, you know, see all the things, to my family is also really cool. Where I live is nice. I like being here. So I'm definitely going to try more next year to have less trips and certainly of less duration as well. So I've got a bunch coming up, but nothing's going to be more than 2 weeks, even to far-flung corners of the world. And that's the way I'm going to try and keep it. So thank you very much for watching. I guess next week is going to be the last one before Christmas. I'm actually going to be in Brisbane Monday, Tuesday, doing my last commercial engagement for the year. I've got some training on Monday and Tuesday that I can drive to. The first time I've ever been able to drive to a workshop from my home. So I'm very excited about that. So I will come to you next week. I'll have a few other cool things happening actually next week. I've got a big thing lined up to do across the period of next week that I won't tell you about just yet, just in case I don't get it all done in time. But I may have a very, very big update to talk about on Friday in terms of this series, which I think is very important. So thank you very much for watching, everyone, and I hope you all have an awesome weekend, and I will catch you next week.